At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum, from center left to center right. I'm Mona Charon of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center, and Damon Linker of The Week. Our special guest this week is John Fasman, who writes for The Economist. And before delving into the week's news about the election and so forth, John Fasman, I have a question for you. First of all, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Here's my question. I love The Economist. It is one of the best publications written in the English language, I would say. But why do you guys call it a newspaper? It looks like a magazine to me.
That is just a, that's just what we do. we seem to have picked a name and we're sticking to it.
I see. Has it always been called a newspaper? How old is The Economist?
The Economist started in 1843.
Okay. And has it always been called a newspaper?
I believe
to your knowledge?
So.
Yeah.
I believe so.
All right. As we speak, the Electoral College count is either 253 to 214, which is the New York Times and a few other sites count, or 264 to 214, Wall Street Journal, I think Politico has it there. There are still votes being counted, but our sitting president of the United States said today, not in a tweet, but in an official statement from his campaign, quote, "If you count the legal votes, I easily win the election. If you count illegal and late votes, they can steal the election from us." All right. So I'd like to do a quick round the horn about a gut check on where everybody thinks we are, both in terms of the likely outcome and which states are going to put Biden over the top, if any. So let's start with you, Bill Galston.
Well, I think the odds are very, very high that Joe Biden will be sworn in on January 20th. How we'll get there is a more complicated question. And there, I don't know which states are going to put him over the top because there are so many to choose among. And the question is, you know, which is definitively settled first? If he got Pennsylvania, that would be enough by itself to put him over the top. If he got Georgia by itself, that would be not quite enough. If he won Arizona and Nevada, he would be the next president of the United States. If he won Georgia and anything else, or North Carolina and anything else, he would be the next president of the United States. So you tell me. I think he has probably the steepest uphill climb in North Carolina. Trump's margin in Georgia has shrunk to under 15,000 votes, and they're still counting. I would not be surprised to see all five of the states that I just mentioned go narrowly for Joe Biden, but I wouldn't be surprised to see one or more of them go in the other direction. So, you know, if you do the odds, I'd say 95% plus for Biden. If you ask me about any individual state, it might be closer to 50-50.
John Fassbin, do you agree with Bill? Are you surprised at anything?
I agree with Bill. I think Joe Biden probably wins. He could win as early as today. I have spent this week in Philadelphia, and Kathy Buchvar, who is Pennsylvania's Secretary of State, said about an hour ago that Pennsylvania could have results by the end of the day. It looks as though the ballots that they're counting come overwhelmingly from Philadelphia and the three close-in suburban counties. Those have been going for Biden by a margin of about 60 points. So Biden's been winning about 80% of them.
Mm.
If he holds with the number of ballots outstanding, then he wins Pennsylvania, which puts him at 273. I think it's also pretty likely that he wins Nevada, Arizona, and quite possibly Georgia. So I expect that he will, that we may well know by the end of the week that he's president.
So since you're in Pennsylvania, have you heard this story that some vote counters in Allegheny County have said that they're taking the day off for administrative work? But can you shed any light on that? I mean, what a day to pick for administrative work, saying, see you tomorrow.
I think the administrative work they're doing, this comes from an Allegheny County, this is from someone, I don't remember the exact affiliation, but someone who knows Allegheny County well. Administrative work means checking ballots that require curing, which requires checking them by hand. So it's administrative work related to the election.
Okay.
It just means they won't have a count at the end of the day, but it's something election related.
Oh, okay. So they're not doing diversity training or
No, right. It's not a day of trust falls.
Okay. All right. Linda, what's your gut check?
Well, my gut is in a mess, I'll tell you, after Tuesday. I think Biden is going to win. It's important to me, as somebody who wants to see Trump absolutely vanquished in terms of a future in politics, to have Biden win all possible states. I think North Carolina is a stretch, but I think he could win the other four, and I'd like to see that happen. The Allegheny County thing, unfortunately, this all sort of feeds into this paranoia fantasy of the Trump supporters who think that there is some fooling around going on with the ballots. And I think that the longer this drags on, the more, it narrows in certain places like Arizona. If we don't see something coming in today, I think that's going to be very bad for the narrative. So I hope it winds up at least by this evening.
But Linda, what's wrong with a narrative that just says we take whatever time it requires to count every vote?
Oh, everybody who is reasonable believes that. Unfortunately, the people packing, AK-47s and other weapons who are showing up outside in parking lots in Arizona and elsewhere don't feel that way. And that makes me very nervous. I am actually nervous about whether or not we might see some violence. And the sooner we get to that 270, the better it will be.
Damon, one of the things that people did worry about was the president's capacity to incite violence among his supporters and to delegitimize any result that he wasn't happy with. Do you agree with Linda that that's becoming more possible the longer the vote drags out? And by the way, even if the vote were not being dragged out, I mean, if it went against the president when 80% of his supporters said they thought he was going to win, does it matter how long it takes?
Well, I think it's a very concerning situation. I have been slightly cheered by the fact that, you know, after all these years now of complaining rightly about the institutional Republican Party's unwillingness to stand up to Trump, that pretty much universally among elected office holders. The response to Trump's acting out since his bizarre temper tantrum tirade at 2:30 a.m. Wednesday morning, where he declared himself the winner, even though he clearly was only the winner if we stopped counting thousands and even millions of uncounted votes. Since then, the response from pretty much everyone has been, whoa, this is ridiculous. This is a democracy. We count the votes. Mike DeWine had a great statement last night, Wednesday night in Ohio, about this. Marco Rubio tweeted about it. Many others have come out and said it. Fox News has been very dismissive of him. So that's good. That's on the positive side. And that is the important thing, because the likely result is that when Biden is declared the winner, which I think he will be, Trump will have a huge temper tantrum. There might be some violence in some places, but as long as the institutions of American government and the media that reports on them hold the line and effectively treat him like a lunatic claiming he's Napoleon when everyone knows he is not, then he becomes the psychotic and the rest of us are sane and we recognize that Joe Biden is the president-elect and it burns itself out within a few days. So I am worried in the short term about some violence breaking out. And on the long term, I'm worried about Trump's ability to, along with some of the conservative media landscape, to kind of cultivate a sort of anti-democratic authoritarian mindset among Trump voters. But in the shorter term, with how we get out of our current straits, I think we do have a pretty clear path that will put this to rest fairly quickly. And whether we get to 270 today or tomorrow, I don't think is probably the most important thing.
I will be very happy when we do get there, though.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Assuming that we do. Because there were moments on election night when I got that sick feeling in the pit of my stomach that was so reminiscent of 2016, when you just feel that the ground under your feet is shifting and you don't know the country that you used to feel you knew. All right. Let us, Linda, I want to turn to you and talk a little bit about Hispanics, because the president did a lot better with Hispanics than anybody thought he would. And that, than he deserved to. Of course, he's done better with every group than he deserves. But it's really, I can't resist the irony here that, you know, a big part of his appeal to his base was that he was so horrible in his language about Hispanics, right? These horrible criminal aliens and immigrants who were coming across the border to steal your jobs and rape your women. And by the way, you know, people like Ann Coulter, who wrote whole books about saying that, you know, if we didn't keep out those darn Hispanics, Republicans would never win another election, and so on. And yet it looks like Trump is improving his standing, with Hispanics, especially Hispanic men. So, Linda, you study this part of the electorate, among others, but tell us what you make of this.
Well, I'm not terribly surprised. First of all, I think you've noticed that in this election, he's not been repeating quite the harsh rhetoric, even on the immigration issue, that he did in 2016. And I think there is a misunderstanding among a lot of people about the Hispanic vote. First of all, there is no Hispanic vote. There are different groups living in different regions of the country, hailing from different parts of Latin America, and they behave differently depending on where they're from. I warned in a piece I wrote in the New York Times 6 weeks or so ago that Biden had to do better among Hispanics than he appeared to be doing, and that he was particularly vulnerable in Florida. You know, some of us laughed at the notion that Joe Biden was a socialist and they were going to basically turn the United States into a socialist country. But if you were from Venezuela or Cuba or Nicaragua and had actually lived under socialist communist leaders, then I think that kind of message resonated more. So the president did better among that vote in South Florida. But he also did better than expected among Mexican Americans in South Texas. Some of this, I think, has to do with the fact that so many Hispanics who are eligible to vote, therefore are citizens, are entrepreneurial. They've got small businesses. Maybe they have a landscaping company. Maybe they have a restaurant. Maybe they've opened a Mercado someplace. When the country shut down because of COVID, they were particularly hard hit. And COVID was a big concern of theirs because it hit them very hard. But it also is true that they wanted to open up, that they needed to get their stores open, to get their businesses running again. And so I think to the degree that they worried that a Biden election might make the country open less quickly, that probably also resonated. So that's why he's doing better among voters that, frankly, he has absolutely no right to have won support from.
So in a way, George W. Bush is vindicated here when he was the one whose rhetoric stressed that Hispanics were natural Republicans.
That's right.
All right, John Fassman, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I think that, as usual, Linda makes a fantastic point about the resonance of the socialism message, particularly in South Florida. I'm very happy with the news that Joe Biden is probably going to be the next president. Having said that, I find two things really cheering about President Trump's success with Hispanic voters. The first is it shows Republicans that they can compete for and win non-white votes. So in that sense, I hope it will lead them to do more of that and focus more on trying to win votes than trying to suppress them. Second of all, I think it's a really good reminder to Democrats that they should not and cannot just assume that Hispanic Americans are a natural constituency for them. One thing I found when I was out reporting in Texas and in Florida is that Republicans were just showing up and asking for people's votes and were in the community in a way that Democrats just weren't. So I think it also testifies to the importance, and I think this is often forgotten, especially among media professionals who spend a lot of time online, but the importance of showing up physically and putting in face-to-face time and shaking hands and listening to people. And so I hope it is a great thing that the Hispanic vote will be competed for in cycles that are ongoing. And I hope that both parties will take those lessons to heart going forward.
Right. And not to treat people as blocks. They're individuals.
Right. That's right.
Right. Right. Okay. Bill Galston, what did you want to add?
Well, I just wanted to add that, and perhaps this is something that Linda could help us understand, there was a very substantial gender gap within the Latino community. And Linda has reminded us that noun community is really a misnomer. I mean, Latino is more like a census category, with huge diversity underneath it. But there was an 8-point gap between Latino men and Latino women. And by the way, there was a 10-point gap between African-American men and African-American women. The only place where there wasn't a sizable gender gap was among white Americans. So what's going on with the gender divide in the Latino community?
Well, I don't want to sound too chauvinistic about this, but the term machismo, it comes from Spanish. And I think there are a lot of folks in the Hispanic community, a lot of men who look at Donald Trump and say he's rich. He's got a beautiful woman on his arm and I'd like to be him. And so I think there is more appeal. And I think, frankly, even in the African-American community. I mean, we all sort of laughed at, the fact that Lil Wayne endorsed Donald Trump. Well, it turns out that, there are a lot of people in the African-American community for whom popular culture means something, and it may have swayed some voters there, too. I just think this gender divide doesn't surprise me, and, the fact that he does better with, say, Mexican-American men than he does with Mexican-American women. That doesn't surprise me either.
This is a really big subject, the gender gap that has become a chasm and that stretches across different ethnic and religious and racial categories in America. I think we need to dig down into this at much greater depth in the coming weeks and months and years, because one of the most dramatic changes that we have seen in our society over the last 40 to 50 years is the change in family structure. The United States leads the world in unstable family situations. No other country, no other developed country, and it may actually be no other country in the world, has more children growing up in multiple households during the course of their maturation from 0 to 18. And there's something like 50% of American kids will spend at least some part of their childhood in a single parent home. And what that translates into is there are a lot of people growing up without fathers and without good models of what it means to be a man. And men, young boys, I raised three of them, they need a positive image of masculinity to aspire to. And if they don't have a positive one, they'll find some other one. And I think that may be part of what we're seeing here with Trump's appeal to certain men, is that obviously it's not all men, not even close, but I would love to see statistics somewhere about how many of the men who support Trump come from unstable families themselves. It'd be interesting. All right. Let us look at, so Damon, you had a pretty fierce column this week talking about what this election means for, or tells us about progressivism. This is it is a rebuke to Donald Trump personally, but it is also, you say, a rebuke to the leftist agenda in this country.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, of course, final evaluations will be pending based on the final breakdown of the vote. But I'm struck by the fact that we talked a tremendous amount in the past several weeks and months about how this was going to be an enormous election, turnout was going to be way up, and that is in fact what we saw. And, you know, Joe Biden, I think, is already definitely on track to receive by far the most votes of any person who's ever run for president, and probably a higher percentage of the population voting for him than ever before. However, we also realize that if that had happened only on the Democratic side, it would have been a massive landslide that some here on this program were hoping for and even predicting.
Yeah, guilty.
And in fact, that did not happen. And why did it not happen? Well, because as of our recording on Thursday around 2:30 in the afternoon, Donald Trump has so far increased his raw vote total over 2016 by 5.4 million votes. That's a lot of new votes for Donald Trump, which means that a lot of people were mobilized on the Republican side as well. And this happened all the way down the ticket. This was all the way down into the Senate races, the House races, and then state houses. Democrats did not do especially well at all, especially measured by the very high expectations and hopes that they brought into this. The House differential between Democrats and Republicans is going to narrow quite a bit. It's going to be a very narrow split, with the Democrats, it looks like, holding a majority, but maybe by single digits. The Senate is almost certainly going to be still in Republican hands. That won't be settled until a couple of, probably two runoff elections in January, God help us. The chance that the Democrats would take both of those seats and barely manage to gain a majority only with Kamala Harris as the deciding vote is quite small. And then in state houses, and then in pickups, the Democrats wanted to pick up seats all over the country in House races in Texas. They lost them all. And then in state houses, they did terribly. So you add it all up, and I think you can conclude that it is, in fact, the case that the right can mobilize an electorate and get people to turn out to vote for the first time in a long time, almost as well as Democrats. Now, once again, it looks like the Democrats are going to beat them overall in the national vote and in the Electoral College this time. But this is trench warfare. It is a war of attrition. It is not any situation where a progressive is going to come in, pack the Supreme Court, add blue states, divide blue states, do all of these, in my mind, really cockamamie proposals that you heard proposed over and over again through the summer and fall from the left, that I think, if anything, it made it far more likely that we end up where we are, which is that Democrats actually don't do nearly as well as they might have if they would just keep their trap shut and just try to win the most votes so that they can do so many good things they want to do and not daydream about, you know, structurally changing the system so they never have to run in a competitive election. Again, it's the Democratic version of Trump trying to shut down the vote count. And I just wish the Democrats would stop with that.
So, Bill, I agree with Damon, though I would say that it wasn't quite daydreaming, although you could put it that way, but part of what seems to have hurt Democrats, and you heard this even from some Democratic state officials in their post-election reflections, was the aggressiveness of the progressive message. That is, defund the police was very damaging. And as I know you wrote quite a bit, you and Damon both did during the summer and fall, about how damaging some of those protests and riots were potentially for Democrats. That does seem to have exacted a price. Don't you agree?
Frankly, Mona, I think it's a little bit too early to say for sure why things turned out the way they did. And, you know, the old distinction between anecdotes and data rears its ugly head here. I was impressed by something else entirely. And that is the electoral failure of the strategy to turn this into a COVID election. And because when you looked at what people said when they were asked for the single factor that was doing the most or had done the most to shape their votes, it wasn't the pandemic, it was the economy. And it was the economy by 2-1. And by the way, law enforcement and race relations were way down the list. So they weren't top of mind for most people. The other thing I would say is that chastising Democrats for failing to achieve a landslide, a real sweep from top to bottom, is really going against the grain of modern history. People aren't frequently aware of this, but this is the 9th consecutive election where no winning candidate has achieved a 10-point or greater margin. This is an extended period of close elections without precedent in American history, regardless of the identity of the candidates. Bottom line, we are not only deeply divided as a country, we are closely divided as a country. And you put those two things together and you have a formula for the sort of politics we've been seeing and also for the sort of legislative gridlocks that we've been living through for so long.
And maybe likely to see more of. Linda, you wanted in on this.
Well, you know, I think you've heard me say this before, Mona, but I frequently remind my liberal friends to be careful what you wish for when you want everybody to vote. The fact that Republicans were able to increase the vote for Donald Trump this time is not a surprise for me. He was able to reach out and get the kind of voters who don't usually vote, register those voters, and get them to the polls. And there are, I believe, as many people who would be supportive of a Donald Trump candidacy out there who don't usually vote as there are those who would be opposed to a Trump candidacy and haven't usually voted. People who don't vote, it's not because they are prevented from voting in most cases. For whatever reason, they choose not to spend their time that way. But simply having universal participation is not going to guarantee a liberal outcome.
All right. One of the things that we have all been scratching our heads over since Tuesday night is the epic failure of polling. The polls were really, really wrong. And I say this as someone who has been saying repeatedly since 2016, you know, the polls really weren't that wrong in 2016. They were wrong in a few key states. That's right. But they were mostly right about the national average. And, you know, all of this beating up on pollsters is illegitimate and wrong. This year, we can't say that, can we, John?
We can't. The thing that disturbs me most about polls this year isn't just that they were wrong, right? Because polls are often wrong. They're a snapshot of the electorate. They're not necessarily predictive, but they were off this year in the same way they were off in 2016, which suggests to me a systemic problem. Now, I don't think we yet know what it is. If I had to guess now, I'd suspect it's a non-response problem, that there is a significant share of Donald Trump's voters that pollsters, for whatever reason, just can't reach, whether it's because they're not using the right method, whether it's because the people they ask don't answer the phone, whether it's because I can't imagine it's that they're not making an effort, but there's a response problem. And when you have that lack of response can't really be accounted for by weights and models. It's really hard to build an accurate model when you don't have data from a significant share of the electorate. So I think that's what I think the polling industry really is going to be doing some soul searching about. How did we get it wrong two presidential elections in a row in the same way? And what is the input that we are not getting?
Yeah. Damon, I'm sure you saw, since I know you're on Twitter a lot, somebody was circulating the screenshot of the polling in the state of Maine, even without Donald Trump being involved, but just all of the polls, and there were about a dozen polling the Senate race there, Susan Collins versus, I've forgotten her name of her opponent right now, but in any event, none of the polls, zero, ever gave Collins the lead. Her opponent was ahead in every single one.
And not just by a few points. One of them was up 13, or she was down, Collins was down 13, 8, 9, 6. It was, I didn't do the average, but the average would have been probably around minus 7. So that, you know, that was going also all the way back to February. So this is a long time standing. So I agree with John. Obviously, I think the problem is obviously a kind of failure to reach not just, I would say, Trump voters, as you point out, Mona, but Republicans. I mean, if I had to speculate, which is really my specialty, so here I go. If I had to speculate, I would say that we're mainly dealing with another manifestation of the Republican Party becoming a kind of anti-institutional party that does not trust pretty much anyone outside of its own tribe, and it sees pollsters as part of the liberal progressive media complex. And so, you know, a pollster calls up and says, "Hi, could I ask you a few questions about your coming vote?" And they just hang up on them. And it doesn't have to be the shy Trump voter thesis, which is, I think, a little more sinister, at least in certain of its forms, where you're imagining a Trump voter who actually says, "Oh yeah, I love Joe Biden. I'm definitely going to vote for him." Mm-hmm. And they go, "Tee hee hee," and may have a laugh after they hang up. that's a little more sinister. I think it's probably a lot more common that people just say, ah, screw you, and just hang up the phone, and they do that over and over again, and you end up with a perennial redundant skew that, as John points out, as a pollster, an honest pollster at least, you cannot compensate for, because it's an unknown unknown. You don't know how many of the people who won't answer the question actually are going to be people who would have said, I'll vote for Susan Collins. And so we effectively have a polling industry that is missing a chunk of the electorate. And as long as that is true, they really cannot be trusted. And then the second order problem is that you have these other people like Nate Silver, who are incredibly smart, has a great team. And he, and like many others, builds these incredibly intricate statistical models that presume that the polls are largely accurate. And so the inaccuracy ends up informing the model too. And
well, can I interrupt for just a second? I don't speak for Nate Silver, but I think what he would say is, we don't assume they're right. We assume that because we do averaging, that we eliminate, you know, the margin of error somewhat. I think that's what he would say.
Yes, of course he would, and I like Nate and admire him a lot, and it is possible to account for some of that, but that too assumes that there's a known unknown. If it's an unknown unknown, meaning yeah, you don't even know what you don't know, then you're going to end up sort of either not really, the model really ends up becoming sort of worthless, or it becomes so broad in its error functions that you're essentially saying, well, Biden could win by 10 or he could lose by 5. And as long as one of those is true, my model is sound. And that's not very helpful.
Right, right. Okay, Linda and then Bill.
Well, just quickly, I think, you know, those of us who've dealt with the race issue over the years know that polls are often wrong about race. And one of the ways you deal with that is you don't ask someone a direct question about their views on racial issues. You try to frame it in such a way that you can get the answer about how they feel by posing the question differently. And of course, you know, I sort of laughed at this Trafalgar Square that basically ask people, who's your neighbor voting for? But, you know, maybe there is some of that. Maybe in places where, you know, Trump, you know, voting for Trump, some people may feel very uncomfortable saying they are. Even with Susan Collins, I mean, Susan Collins got a lot of grief because of her views, you know, on a variety of issues, including the court cases. So maybe you do need to come up with some proxy way of analyzing how some people truly feel on a given race.
Bill.
Just a cautionary note. I know on election night, even people who've been reading learned articles about the famous blue shift and predictions that it would be magnified because of the different mode of voting this time, we tended to throw that aside, cast that aside, and respond to what we were seeing at the moment. And I mention this because as we speak, there are still 18 million ballots left to be counted, and they are not symmetrical in their likely political orientation. So at the national level, we don't know how large the miss will be. I could easily make a back of the envelope calculation suggesting that Biden will win the national popular vote by between 4 and 5 percentage points. And so the surveys in the last week of the campaign that put it at about 6 were not that wildly wrong. You can also name a number of states where the polls were really right on the money, including many of the states that we're now talking about on this program. There were big misses in states where Trump did very well in 2016, and there was some suggestion that he would do much worse this time around. States like Ohio and Iowa and Texas, and it turned out that he did just as well in those states this time around as others. So I think the jury is still out on how wrong the polls were, either at the national level or the statewide level. There were a lot of Senate misses, that's for sure, but that's a somewhat different question.
Well, I hope that we will be able to get to the bottom of this and get it fixed, because there's quite a bit at stake beyond just getting elections wrong and gauging how elections are going. You know, for example, we continually rely on public opinion polling for policymaking purposes. We consult, not that, you know, it's an iron law, but we do consult it. How many people favor the Affordable Care Act, or how many people want to pull out of the Iran deal, or whatever it is. I mean, Americans are constantly being asked their views. And if we're missing a significant percentage of the population in these polls, that's really disqualifying for those surveys. So we need to figure it out and get it fixed, it seems to me. But Bill, I want to stay with you just for a minute to talk about one thing we haven't mentioned. We haven't praised anybody much this podcast, but I think it's worth noting the importance of candidates. Since we were talking about Susan Collins, you know, you have to say that Susan Collins has managed election after election to do something that's actually quite difficult, because the northern part of Maine is much more conservative than the southern part of Maine, and you've always kind of had to be careful and split the difference and do a lot of good constituent service and all the rest of it, and it's not easy, and she's managed to walk that tightrope very effectively, so she deserves kudos for that. But I also wanted you to talk, if you would, for a second, Bill, just about Biden, because, you know, one of the things that the Democrat had to do in 2020 was to boost Black turnout above what Hillary Clinton was able to get in 2016, and also eat into Trump's margins with white working class voters. And it looks like Biden was able to do both those things.
Yeah, I agree. Certainly the national surveys indicate that. And so what we have overall is a picture in which Biden did substantially better among white Americans than Hillary Clinton did, while Trump did somewhat better among both African Americans and Latinos than he did in 2016. Biden also did much better, something like 9 points better, among white working class voters. And you know, and so the premise of the Biden candidacy, namely that he could balance a successful outreach to the African American community with a higher level of acceptability to the kinds of voters who flocked so enthusiastically to Donald Trump in 2016, turns out to have been in the main correct. And I would go so far as to say that it's not clear to me, based on the outcome, that any other Democrat on offer could have achieved the same result, because once the Florida dream went a glimmering, the blue wall states took on renewed importance, and I think it's fair to say that Biden's overall persona, his moderate affect, his constant reference to blue-collar working-class roots and identification with people who are in that part of the population certainly helped to take the edge off that group's antipathy to Democrats and the Democratic Party. And frankly, I don't think anybody else could have. So the party made not only a winning choice, but the choice that may have been its only winning choice.
I agree with that. Linda, one of the things that some of us had hoped would happen from this election, and one of the reasons that we were hoping for really a rout by Democrats, was so that Trumpism would be not only defeated but discredited, and that the Republican Party would be obliged to reflect on this and go in a different direction. And that
does not seem likely at all. The Democrats didn't take a single house of any state legislature in the country. In fact, they lost two, I think, as of this moment. It looks like they are not going to be able to gain control of the United States Senate. They've lost support in the House. And the tone of the Republicans doesn't seem to change. The new senator-elect from Alabama told his critics, that's Tommy Tuberville, go to hell and get a job. Another newly elected Republican is Madison Cawthorn in North Carolina, who won the Mark Meadows seats, who's the youngest, will be the youngest member, whose sentiment was expressed with "cry more, lib." So it looks like the reform of the Republican Party will have to wait, Linda.
Well, it's even worse than that. In fact, Joe Biden wins, you know, Donald Trump is talking about running again. You know, we've all sort of hoped that he would slink back in, you know, back to Mar-a-Lago or back under the rock from which he emerged in 2015, but doesn't look like that's going to happen. But I do think that you are going to see a split in the Republican Party. Yes, there are, you know, the Cawthorns and the woman Green, who's the QAnon person in the House, the Republican. There are going to be, you know, the Tommy Tubervilles and others who are going to ride the Trump train. But I think there are also going to be people who, now that Trump can't really do anything for them in the White House, who are going to be, act more responsibly. I think we're going to see a slightly different Mitch McConnell, even as the majority leader, than we've seen in the past. I think that on policy issues, you may see some shifting. And I'm hopeful that there will still be an opportunity for non-Trumpist Republicans to be able to come back and play a greater role. And interestingly, that's going to be helped by the fact that some of the more moderate members, or people who at least were moderate on some issues, are, you know, some of the Republicans are back in office. You know, the Susan Collinses, the Tillis victory. I mean, he's been somebody who's been, you know, more open on some immigration issues, for example. So I think that battle is going to continue. I'm not willing to give up on it. And time will tell whether the Trumpists are going to ultimately, you know, split. And those of us who are not Trumpists have to find a new home. But unfortunately, I still don't see that home in the Democratic Party.
Not to hold grudges or anything, but was Tom Tillis the one who wrote that op-ed saying that he could never vote for Trump's illegal border wall diversion of funds because of, for his spurious state of emergency, and then went ahead and voted for it?
Yeah. True enough, but I hope that the original sentiment was his gut, and he just got beat up enough on it that he got pulled back in. But look,
well, then he's a gutless wonder.
Well,
so
they're all gutless wonders. I mean, are you surprised at that?
No. All right. Okay. John Fassman, you know, as we mentioned earlier, something like 80% of Trump's supporters believe that he was going to win this election. How do you think they will handle it? Will there be a stab in the back narrative that he was robbed and terrible bitterness and distrust of the electoral system? I mean, do you see that as a possible outcome of this election?
Well, I don't think Trump will ever really admit that he lost. That's not what he does, right? So he will always maintain the story that he has been betrayed. And I suspect there will always be some share of his voters who believe that to be true. On the broader question that suggests, though, I'm not convinced that Trump will remain this, that Trump will retain the sort of personal control and personal influence over the party that a lot of people are worried he will. I mean, first of all, when he leaves office, he's going to be in enormous financial and legal trouble, right? He will have, he has debts that are coming due, $400 million worth of debts that are coming due that he's personally guaranteed. Cyrus Vance is nipping at his heels. And I also think you can't underestimate the number of elected Republican officials who just really don't like him personally. They would never say that out loud. They would never say that on the record. They will back him in public. But I think they will look for any opportunity to lessen his influence. So maybe he forms a media company in which he maintains the fiction that he was cheated and he gets viewers. And sort of to make that work, he needs an aggrieved base to go with him. So he will maintain that. The extent to which he and that fiction shape the future of the Republican Party is unclear. And I suspect it may be a lot less than people worry it will be right now.
Interesting. Here's a quote from Richard Blumenthal, senator from Connecticut, who said, "Removing the toxic element of Trump could really change things. I know that sounds like a Pollyanna-ish hope, but Trump's vile and toxic unpredictability made compromising difficult, and maybe, just maybe, removing Trump from the mix could add a notion of rational thinking and sanity with some Republicans." Damon, what do you think about that?
Thanks. Thanks for that pitch. Okay, well, I have to say I just don't know. I mean, my answer to that a few days ago would have been slightly different after I saw the general shape of what I said earlier about the surge in new voters, or at least, you know, I don't know if they're totally new, but at least the fact that Trump has added to the number of people supporting him and that this election is as close as it is, at least at the Electoral College level. I'm inclined to think, as many others have said, that Trumpist-style politics, not necessarily Trump himself, who is uniquely polarizing, uniquely repulsive to a lot of Americans. He'll be on the sidelines. He'll be tweeting. He will probably use the promise of him running in 2024 for the biggest boondoggle fundraising escapade we've ever witnessed. He will raise hundreds of millions of dollars off of the promise. And then in the end, he probably will not do it. Because remember, he's going to be 78 in November of 2024. Joe Biden is about that old and he's done it, but, is he really going to be up for it? We'll see. He could go on a whirlwind tour around the country and do regular rallies and charge ticket prices for them. I mean, who knows what kind of nonsense he's going to come up with. But I do think that the general Trumpian style, and that has a style, purely stylistic component, the nastiness, the insults, the kind of bottom feeding character to the rhetoric and the approach to politics will, I think, definitely persist in the party. And then on policy, I think there is still a strong case to be made that there is an underserved demographic of Americans that combine a sort of moderately conservative position on cultural questions, and then sort of, by American terms, liberal on economics. So sort of what Joe Biden wants to do on economic policy, with healthcare, with tax policy and other things, combined with something that's even a little more centrist to slightly center-right on social issues than even Biden. And if a Republican could come on the scene that combined a kind of charismatic sort of Trumpian brashiness without the repulsiveness, and then on policy pitch something like what I just described, I think that could be a sort of blockbuster combination for Republicans. Now, whether there is a person who could do that, and make it through the gauntlet of the party with its kind of economically libertarian wealthy donors and so forth is a huge question. And I'm a little skeptical that it structurally it can work. But I do think that that's one possible future we should be thinking about.
What I would love to see is some kind of Republican or Democrat, for that matter, who could seize the patriotism mantle, who could defend the history of the United States, the spirit of this country against those on the progressive left who want to tear down everything and who believe that the essence of American history is its worst aspects, slavery, discrimination, Jim Crow, and so on and so forth. Whereas, you know, a more balanced view of that is that those are obvious stains on our history, but they don't define us, and that we have transcended some of those problems and we continue to seek to improve. I do think that the hatred of all things regarding American history offends a lot of people, but on the other hand, the response on the right has been so hateful too. They've retreated into sort of white identity politics and defending, God help us, the Confederacy, which is exactly the wrong way to answer that criticism. So that's another sort of bit of unfinished business from 2016 that I think we're going to continually see played out. All right, we've come now to the part of the program where we all do our highlights and lowlights of the week, and I'm going to start with Bill Galston.
Well, I'm going to do the traditional thing and pick out an article that I think is well worth reading across party lines. And my selection this week is the article that Will Salatin, who's appeared on this program more than once, posted to Slate, you know, called If Memory Serves, A Warning for Democrats, in which he uses the available information very, very skillfully to point out the dangers of some of the false assumptions that Democrats, including progressive Democrats, have made about the electorate and the prospects for their agenda.
I second that. I read it. John Fasman.
Well, I guess the low light of the week news was clearly the President of the United States' speech at 2:30 in the morning, casting doubt on the outcome of the election, something tremendously irresponsible we've never seen a president do. The highlight, I'll go a bit off the news. As you may know, for our Christmas issue every year, we get to write a long passion piece, a sort of a piece about something that interests us. I'm writing this year about Reconstruction, and I've been reading Eric Foner's fantastic book about how the Reconstruction Amendments reshaped American jurisprudence and really America itself. And it's a salutary reminder that our worst times also contain the capacity for renewal, and that's what really makes America great, is our ability to correct our mistakes. So that is what I've been thinking about this week.
Excellent. You know, I have a son, David, who is a PhD candidate, and he's reading the exact same book. So how about that? All right. Linda.
Well, I want to point out something that hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, but certainly is very near and dear to my heart. You undoubtedly remember, Mona, that back in the mid-1990s, the state of California overwhelmingly endorsed the idea that we should not discriminate either against anyone or for anyone on the basis of color in college admissions, in contracting, or in employment. And there was a measure on the ballot in California this time around, put there by the state legislature, which would have struck down that provision of the California Constitution. And in very blue California, very diverse California, very woke California, the voters rejected that effort to take that provision out of the Constitution. And that to me is good news, because I don't think we should pick winners or losers on the basis of color. And I think that the way in which Proposition 209, the original one from the 1990s, worked out was that, yes, you may have had some fewer African-American and Hispanic students going to schools like Berkeley in California, but you had a whole lot more going to schools in which their grades and their test scores allowed them not just to get in, but actually to complete their four-year degrees. So I'm very happy that Californians voted to, again, basically say color should not determine whether you win or lose.
And also very much file under the Will Salatin piece in Slate about lessons for the left. This is yet another one from 2020. Damon.
You know, I was going to actually pick yet another piece that made a version of this argument about progressives, but it'll be too much like we're all saying the same thing. So in changing it up slightly, although not that much, because I've pointed to this guy before, Ross Douthat, who we should invite onto the program sometime. About
yes.
That.
Good idea.
He's a lot of fun and really smart. I mean, for my money, he's the best columnist in America right now, even though he's a click or two to my right, but not by much. But not, I'm such a middle of the road guy. That's not so surprising. He contributed, along with all the other columnists at the New York Times last Sunday, to a symposium titled What We've Lost About the Trump Years. And his contribution was, for my money, the best of the bunch. Online, it's currently titled, Have We Learned Nothing After 4 Years of Trump? And it's a very, very nice overview of the situation in the country, and in typical Douthat form, although he is a conservative, it's very even-handed and sort of has some criticisms for both sides in a way that myself, Mr. Both Side himself, I really appreciate it. So I'm going to plug that for our listeners.
Very good. I would like to draw attention to a letter that appeared in the Wall Street Journal this week, where they had published an editorial quoting former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who once said about Joe Biden that he had been wrong about the most important foreign policy questions in his career. And they published this letter where Gates said, look, it's perfectly okay for you to repeat my criticism of Biden, but you left out some things, and fairness requires me to note, he said, that he also said that Mr. Biden was a man of genuine integrity and character. It's also worth noting, he wrote, that in these very pages, I wrote that Donald Trump is stubbornly uninformed about the world and how to lead our country and government, and temperamentally unsuited to lead our men and women in uniform. He is unqualified and unfit to be commander in chief. So bravo to Mr. Gates for saying what needed to be said both times. We thank all of you for listening. Thank you, John Fasman, for joining us. I hope you'll come back another time. And I just want to mention to our listeners that if you are listening to us on your browser, that's great, but it might be easier for you and better for us if you just put us in your podcast feed. And that way you can take us with you when you go for a walk or grocery shopping or wherever else you may be. So thanks one and all. We will be back next week as every week. Thanks for listening.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.